The information and opinions presented in this ARC Energy Ideas podcast are provided for informational purposes only and are subject to the disclaimer link in the show notes.
This is the ARC Energy Ideas podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Welcome to the ARC Energy Ideas podcast. I'm Jackie Forrest.
And I'm Peter Terzakian. Well, Jackie, it's a Friday afternoon. It's being recorded on January 29th, and it's been a real roller coaster ride, I must say. As someone who's been in the financial markets for 25 years, I've never seen anything quite like this. We've got the whole GameStop, AMC, that whole BlackBerry, the hedge funds versus the mob inside Reddit. Boy, well, you can follow all that stuff online in terms of what's going on, though it's very complicated to understand if you really think about the implications to the capital markets. So we do want to talk about the capital markets. We do want to talk today about the equity markets as it relates to more fundamentals and as it relates to energy, especially oil and gas. It's been a while since we've had a guest on our show that can help us navigate to understanding the state of the oil and gas industry. I think it's particularly appropriate given that the price of oil is over $50. Mm-hmm. It's been hanging in there.
And the oil and gas stocks, although pounded down for a good part of the year, have really started to show some life.
Yeah, so we want to talk about that and try and understand the fundamentals of oil and gas equities here in Canada. There's been a lot of consolidation. There's a lot of changes. I mean, today's oil and gas industry is not the oil and gas industry of even 2 or 3 years ago. So I am delighted to introduce our special guest, who I've known for a long time, Trent Baim, Vice Chairman and Head of Energy Sales for Stifel First Energy. Welcome, Trent.
Thanks so much. On behalf of my partners at Stifel First Energy and also my partners in Toronto at Stifel GMP, it's a great honor to be with you guys.
Well, great. Why don't you start off by telling us a little bit about Stifel First Energy?
We were an employee-owned partnership formed in the late 90s, and we were quite instrumental in the growth of the Calgary and the Canadian energy sector for many, many years. And we adapted and grew with the sector and spent a lot of time, particularly in the teens, telling our clients that they needed to become more efficient and control their costs more, get bigger, and dispense that kind of advice. And there was a point in time along the way where we realized, well, wait a minute, we should probably be thinking about taking our own advice. And so in 2016, did take our own advice and merged with another legendary Canadian investment banking franchise, my great business partners at GMP. And after a few years there, as Peter and Jackie would know, there's been absolutely tremendous whirlwind of change in this industry. We realized that even our now larger company would benefit from being even larger. So we were very, very pleased to have been approached by Stifel out of the United States, who had been trying to identify a pathway into Canada for many, many years and had looked at our franchise and seeing our effectiveness across a variety of sectors, thought that this might be a company that they should approach. So now we're in a great situation. We have, in my opinion, the best platform in Canada. We cover virtually every sector in the industrial world, cover 3,500 stocks. We're one of the largest underwriters in North America. Today, we just reported our Q4 2020 financial results, and we eked out another record, so the 26th consecutive annual record in revenues. It's a great platform. It gives us a window into a variety of industries. For me personally, it's been utterly eye-opening to see how the different sectors in the economy interact with one another, and also, more importantly, in delivering a message to my clients in the energy sector, maybe taking a look at the perspective of how non-energy investors value companies and value businesses and risk. That's not something that we could have done on a smaller platform. So for us, it's been an outstanding change in terms of being able to add value to our clients.
With that, let's talk a little bit then about the equity markets that you watch and maybe the overall markets, since you talk about the fact that you got a broader perspective. I mean, the overall markets did surprisingly well last year. I mean, they all fell just like oil and gas fell hard in that March timeframe. But by the end of the year, the overall indexes, things like the TSX Composite or the Dow Jones Index, were actually higher than they were, or at least at the same level as around the same time a year earlier. So did that surprise you? And what have been the drivers that the overall markets have done so well? They seem to have COVID immunity.
Well, put it to you this way. We were all shocked when the collapse came. you just can't experience something of that dramatic nature without questioning some of the parameters at which you underpin your basic assumptions about how to serve your clients and make money. But it became clear shortly into the downturn that this might now be one of the greatest opportunities that we've ever seen in our careers for certain companies. And for our listeners, I guess I'd bring forward a few statistics. Something like 28% of the S&P 500 is information technology companies. About 14% is healthcare companies. 13% are consumer discretionary companies. And 11% are communication services businesses. That forms two-thirds of all of U.S. public market equity capitalization. It's really quite a striking number. And our team in the U.S. realized very, very quickly that COVID was going to be an almost indescribable catalyst that will accelerate the automation and the digitalization of our society, and that the earnings profile of these businesses was about to go ballistic. Essentially, it brought forward, in many cases, the earnings profile of some companies by 5 years or more. And so we were very, very busy sending that message out into the market through all of 2020.
And as that message went out last year and the realization set in of that transformation of those service and technology companies, we'll call that the new economy, the old economy really cratered, right? And it's only been recently that it's starting to come back, right?
Well, you know, it was a torrid bounce off the bottom. But I would say between March and November, our traditional, call it smokestack industry sectors, kept up with the broader market from an extremely low base. And just to put some of these statistics into the conversation, those four sectors that I talked about are 66% of the S&P 500. Mm. Of that, Amazon was 4.8%, while the entire energy sector at the bottom was about 1.8% of the S&P 500.
Wow.
So when we say, how did the stocks do in the energy sector coming off at the bottom? Well, actually, they did quite well. You know, they more than doubled, some tripled. There were some huge wins. But we're talking about a sector that had been effectively written off for dead in probably the most literal sense.
Mm-hmm.
Where there was an interesting change in the tempo of the market occurred late last year, right around November timeframe, when suddenly all of these value-oriented sectors like copper, oil and gas, some of the other material sectors started performing much better than the historical growth sectors that were really hot off the bottom.
What do you think is driving that move up? Are these capital inflows coming from greater interest from generalists, from institutional investors? Like, what's driving those increases?
Well, you know, that is a narrative I think that I've heard a few times in the financial press, but you know what? I'm going to take the other side of that. I don't think that's the case. But getting back to that statistic, 2% weight for the energy sector in the broad indexes, what that means is an institution doesn't really have to pay attention to his or her energy book. They really don't need to be there. If they get the call right in energy, that's not going to matter much in their year-end compensation or their relative performance against the index. The calls they got to get right are in the big indexes. And so the way I'd characterize it is, I believe that these stocks are up very nicely only because the people that have been in the stocks traditionally realize now that they're just worth a lot more than they were a year ago or near 9 months ago during the middle of the crash, and that they're going to survive. The bankruptcy discount is gone. And the companies are genuinely stronger and healthier. Mm-hmm. And so what we have right now is a reasonable, I'd say reasonable valuations for reasonable businesses. If it's all right, I'll relate an anecdote from an event that occurred just this Monday.
Sure. Yeah.
My firm did a financing for a Canadian oil and gas company. And it was the largest financing we've seen in a long time, probably 3 or 4 years, well over $100 million financing. And there haven't been many financings in Canada. In fact, this was the second one in about a year. You know, it's just been really, really quite quiet. So I called one of my Wall Street clients and I said, listen, we have a deal. You need to do this deal. It's priced right. It is accretive. All shareholders will benefit, including existing shareholders. And he said, you know what? We are dying to get energy exposure. I'll take 20% of the deal. I was ecstatic. this gentleman manages $50 billion. Well, he called me back a half hour later. He said, Trent, I'm really embarrassed. I have to take this order out of the book. And I said, why is that? He said, well, I've got 5 or 6 deals going on right now. And in order to get this deal past my compliance guys, I have to jump through some hoops. And the size of the investment's just too small. I just can't be bothered. I've got too much other stuff to do. And the reason I draw that anecdote is the big money does want energy exposure. They do. But it's almost as though the entire sector is too small. So I believe that the institutional capital in size isn't going to come until these stocks double again.
Right. And so let's take the Converse. They've been really pounded down. I mean, actually, there was some crazy statistic at the low, some of the small cap names down by 90%. And so this shrinkage has led to, obviously, a capital exodus over the last couple of years. I mean, this is money that's typically allocated for energy, but it's also assets, you know, rocks in the ground. Did it all go to clean energy, or where did that money go?
Did it all go to clean energy? It's a funny question, because I had a conversation with another investor today, and I was trying to schedule some meetings with our energy analyst. I hadn't spoke to her in months. So I said, well, did you want to meet Bob and Cody, our two upstream analysts? And she replied, no, I'm good. I'm totally ESG these days. I don't have anything in oil and gas, probably never will. So there is some of that, particularly within large institutions that feel like social credit is now part of their investment process. What I would say to you is that the oil and gas sector lost their audience when it became evident that they wouldn't be able to adapt to the kinds of industrial metrics such as profitability metrics and dividend debt adjusted growth, return of capital, those types of things in a timely manner. And it was at that point in time when probably in 2016, 17, when we started to see a lot of investors sort of leave the industry and approach some of those other sectors we talked about in the opening segment.
If we go back to that time frame, you know, not that long ago, even 18, when ESG was really emerging, I mean, there was the ESG issue, but there was also at that time still the reality that the oil and gas industry was higher cost, wasn't making any money, not giving back money to shareholders. And so the combination of ESG and lack of profitability led to the exodus. But there's been a real sea change in terms of cost reduction, it seems. And all of a sudden, through the consolidation, I think we're going to see more. So do you think that's going to attract more money? And, you know, the anecdote you related that the deals are going to be of sufficient size for investors to come back?
Absolutely. Capital will always flow towards areas of high return. And Peter, unfortunately, you and I have been around for a long time. And I think you and I would agree that we have actually never seen businesses in our sector post the kinds of financial returns they're posting now, which, by the way, also happens to be at a time when energy prices are just sort of middling.
Yeah, I mean, the adaptability. You know, everybody thought it was over for oil sands when the price went sub 20, momentarily went to zero. Okay, this is it. These are the highest cost guys. They're going out of business. It's over, right? That was kind of the narrative. But actually, the Canadian oil and gas industry's production has actually almost fully recovered. Recovered more than the Americans.
Well, the Americans are down from 13 to 11.
And we're becoming one of the most resilient places around.
The other side of this, though, is, you know, everyone's moving to net zero 2050. We're going to the new economy. Everyone has conviction that COVID is only accelerating that. I read Larry Fink's letter, you know, where he talked about capitals being reallocated even faster than he thought because of COVID. And people are wanting to go to clean energy. Now, I would argue that some of these oil and gas producers are going to move in that net zero direction too, but is that going to keep investors away?
There's absolutely no doubt that there's an audience of investors that will never touch an oil and gas stock, Jackie. And I don't think there's anything we can do to change that. But a person much smarter than me wrote something a few weeks ago that I thought was very profound. And we are in a period of time where society is causing the producers of energy, of the most efficiently transported, highly potent energy source in the world, they're causing those producers to have extremely high costs of capital, while at the same time blessing consumers of energy with a very low cost of capital. And that's creating what is becoming a stark imbalance in the energy supply demand structure in the world. And I don't think anybody's noticed it yet.
Mm-hmm.
But they will notice. They are going to notice very, very quickly. We're starting to see it in the inventory statistics. We're getting these anomalous, gigantic draws in the U.S. inventory statistics on a weekly basis at periods when they should be building stocks in order to prepare for a driving season. I mean, these are really interesting anomalies that I just don't think you can ignore. The other aspect about this sector that's so compelling right now is that the entrepreneurs and business people have really taken to heart the lessons of growth for the sake of growth.
Mm-hmm.
And the messaging that we hear from companies from the largest to the smallest are that they are not going to expand their capital programs very much, if at all, regardless of energy prices.
Mm-hmm.
Peter, had you ever heard anything like that in your career?
This shift, this paradigm shift, because for decades it was grow your production, whatever the cost, because the world needs oil, and so on and so forth. The shift to grow your profitability and lower your cost, you know, that was a paradigm shift that actually occurred circa 2018. And here in Canada, I mean, I think that a lot of the companies have taken heart to that and they're consolidating, as I said. And I don't think the realization has set in that the oil and gas industry can innovate hard, can reduce its costs, and compete hard for market share going forward. And for the first time, maybe deliver sustainable returns in the form of dividends, regardless of the ups and downs of the top line commodity market. Is that fair to say?
I couldn't agree more. And I would add another wrinkle to the situation. I'm assuming that most of our listeners are going to have some familiarity with the energy sector. But for those that don't, there's something in our sector that we call declines. And that is an oil well runs out eventually. And I have a saying, declines never sleep. We have just gone through basically a year of the absolute minimum of capital spending. In fact, we might as well say there was no capital spending. We were well below sustaining capex around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And those declines just kept on coming.
Yeah.
And it's going to be extremely difficult for this industry to recover its peak oil production. And much, much more difficult, I believe, than it will be for our customers to reach peak demand.
It's kind of a lesson in price signals work, right? The price fell, and actually the supply side is adjusting to those price signals. And it's also adjusting to a shift in investment paradigm, make me money, give me dividends, and adjust to the new realities that are forming. But I also want to comment on this notion about, Jackie, you know, net zero by 2050, and there's certainly a lot of talk about that. That's 2050. There's a lot of philosophizing about 2050. What Trent's talking about is what's coming down in the next 20 months, let alone the next 20 years, 30 years. This is the dynamic that's kind of being set up with all these disruptive changes that are going on.
Here's the thing, though. I do believe that the market will tighten up here. I don't know if it's going to be, you know, in the next near months or a few years out. And these companies show restraint, which we'll see if they really do, and they give all this money back to shareholders. There's a value that investors put on those future cash flows, and they value the company, you know, based on some idea of how far out in the future they go. Trent, I'd be interested in your view on how oil and gas companies are valued on their future cash flows versus other sectors. I think it's a lot lower. You know, the cash flow, even though it may be the same coming from company A, that's a clean tech company, as an oil and gas company, the company is valued less because it's an oil and gas company. And that net zero, it can kind of make people have more uncertainty about future cash flows and therefore not value the company as well as a clean tech company where they think it has much greater prospects further out. Did that make sense?
Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense. It's a complicated subject because in one case, you are growing, sort of valuing a business model that is in rampant growth mode versus one that is sort of mature and generating strong returns. So what we try to do at Stifel First Energy is look at what would this company look like, whatever it is, doesn't matter what it does, if it just had to do the same thing next year as it was doing this year. And what we learned when we looked at a lot of these renewable businesses, like some of the legitimate ones, is that, you know what? They're good businesses. And then we tried to compare, okay, well, how about our businesses? How do they compare? And you could imagine there's a normal distribution of companies that are good and not so good in both sectors. Now, clean energy companies are growing. They're generally getting stronger valuations.
Yeah, so the cash flow they have over the next few years, they're valued at many multiples higher than that. And the oil and gas companies, because they're viewed to be flat to declining, people are not going to value them as highly because of that uncertainty around the future and their growth.
They were flat to declining and not making any money. I think that's kind of the key, right? At a time when renewable energy companies, their costs were falling and they were actually delivering a return, it's going to be interesting to see when quarterly number comes out now. You know, as the oil price is above $50, it's got some firmness. Costs have been reduced, so the cash flows are actually probably going to look pretty good going forward. And all of a sudden, you're going to have companies that are making money and leaner and meaner and set up for the future. So we'll see how the rotation of capital from investors goes.
Listen, I'm really excited about this entire sector, and I can feel the eyes rolling among some of the listeners who might have more of a clean energy bent. Let's listen to this old oil and gas guy. But listen, I have to tell you, I am so excited about this clean energy sector, Peter, because it reminds me of where we were back in 98.
Yeah.
When the oil and gas sector was rocking and rolling, and you had everything from the Cowboys to Alberta Energy, and it was fun, and the innovation was unbelievable. Yeah. Remember when they drilled the first horizontal well in Queensdale, and they thought those guys were lunatics? And it's changed the world. That exact same thing is happening in the clean energy sector right now.
Yeah.
And it's exciting. And I love it. And, you know, being part of it in my job is incredible. I'm the luckiest man in the world.
Hmm.
By the same token, I am dismayed at the polarization of the discussion, because I do feel that there's a tremendous disservice is being done by making the other side the enemy, because we're going to run out of oil and gas. I just don't think that you can transform an energy infrastructure globally that took 120 years to build in a decade.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't think you can do it. Even if you dedicated a Marshall-style process, it can't be done.
Yeah, the entrenched infrastructure, just the sale of oil at $50, I don't know, just sort of really super back-of-the-envelope calculation. It's a $1.8 trillion industry in some of the worst times that we've seen in a long time. So I mean, trying to displace that is a monumental task. But let's get back to the sort of the emerging, budding renewal of the industry, I'll call it. And then a headline like KXL comes out. What are your investors?
Starting last summer, you could see it in their stock charts that investors started to apply a curtailment to the net present value of some of these big infrastructure projects. You could call it maybe assigning a risk.
So, like a handicap. Yeah.
A handicap, exactly. So these investors, they say, you know what? I might wake up tomorrow and Enbridge could have line 5 shut down. It could happen.
Mm-hmm.
So you know what? I have to assign some risk for that. So you know what? I'm going to assign a higher discount value in my net present value calculation. I'm not going to pay as much for that stock. Or maybe I won't even bother buying it to begin with. So there's no doubt that it happens, 100%.
Do you think it affects the value of the oil and gas companies here in Western Canada? Because,
absolutely.
You know, it kind of reinforces the fact that Canada is a tough place, can't build pipelines.
Well, there's no doubt, and I don't want to get into a political discussion, but Canada has done no favors to itself in terms of making investors feel like commercial and industrial development is welcome. I have actually had investors tell me, we can't invest in Canada because we just don't know if you guys can get anything built. I've had those exact words directly quoted at me. Big, important investors.
My counter to that would be, well, look at Biden's announcing he's suspending exploration and development. A lot of these U.S. pipelines, even with Donald Trump, were struggling, the North Dakota Access. So it's not that it's easy to do these things or it's unique to Canada, these problems.
No, it's certainly not. You know, we have this new relationship with Stifel, and they have some of the best energy analysts, energy teams in the world, in Europe and in the U.S., and Jackie, I'm telling you, they are saying the exact same things we said in 2015 when we started to get the first hint that maybe there's some cool winds blowing across the prairies.
Mm-hmm.
And to my American friends, I've cautioned them. I've said, you cannot underestimate these factors. I would say to you that regulatory and policy factors are much more important than market factors. much more important, particularly in today's day and age where politicians respond to a tweet. I think that they're much more important, and we could get some nasty surprises out of the United States for sure.
Yeah, we could. Hey, we started off the conversation talking about wading towards technology and so on, then we went into oil and gas, but isn't the theme even broader in terms of resource stocks? And you guys have done some resource deals in lithium, and battery metals are starting to move and things like that?
Oh, you bet. Again, this comes back to my comment earlier about the energy transition. I'm all on side. I am on side. It's exciting. And by the same token, most people don't understand the amount of capital, the amount of time it's going to take.
Yeah.
I scribbled down one little anecdote for you to maybe consider. So in the world, on an annual basis, we make about 350,000 tons of lithium. And it takes a ton of lithium to make about 20 EVs, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So that works out to about 400,000 or 500,000 EVs. So we are all reliably informed. We're all going to be driving EVs by when, Peter? 2030?
Oh, yeah. No, next year.
Peter will come over and let you drive his around. So you'll be buying one by next week.
But listen, so 350,000 tons, that's, what did I say, 500,000 cars. Well, global annual light vehicle sales are 8 million cars per month.
Yeah.
So what are we going to do? You know, I'm on side with this program, but we need to invest in lithium. And there are two or three big projects that we've financed over the last few weeks. And on average, those are 20,000 ton per projects per year. Mm-hmm. We need 5 million tons.
We're not even talking about copper, nickel, cobalt, and all the other things that go into these things. And I wrote an article in the Financial Post just recently. People don't understand the scale. One standard electric vehicle battery, we're not even talking about a pickup truck or anything, it's equivalent of 5,000 cell phone batteries.
Yeah.
And you think about the draw on our mineral resources that potentially is forthcoming. And you know, you and I've been around finance for a long time, especially commodities. And you sort of reach this point where the supply-demand tightens up, and all of a sudden you get these price spikes. And I kind of sense that that's what's been going on in the last few weeks, certainly the last few months. Like you look at nickel is at a five-year high.
Nickel, lumber, copper, the list goes on and on. Sugar, coffee, the commodity sector, there's something going on there, and people are in denial about it. But the people who are in these industries know how hard it is to extract these minerals and resources.
Mm-hmm.
Copper is a really interesting subject, Peter, because this is a very, very important substance. And it's been in a bear market for a long time, like 10 or 12 years. And it's only recently just come out of it. And the result of that is that no one was really even exploring for this stuff. And one of the last large mines to be commissioned was commissioned last year. Like there's nothing scheduled for a very long time.
Mm.
Now, the difference between the oil and gas sector and the copper sector is that the price can do whatever it wants, but the prospects to develop aren't there. So what can the industry do? Well, I suppose it can low grade their mines and process lower grade ore and all that other good stuff. So that'll keep up for a while. But the market is going to have to give this industry a price signal to get out there and find some more copper, because we got a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, when we'll put a link to Peter's article, because Peter talked about the fact that, you know, this may elevate the cost of some of these options and slow down the energy transition more than people are banking on. Well, Trent, we didn't follow our script at all, but it was a great conversation. Thank you very much for just explaining what's going on with the market. And
it was my pleasure. And if I can just finish with one comment, because I just don't know who's listening, but if there's anybody in university who's listening to this podcast, I'm going to say this. The energy sector, whether you go into clean energy or oil and gas, is going to be the most exciting and dynamic sector the world has ever seen for the next 20 years, because our society needs to make changes just as much as we can't. You know, I've just gone on saying it's going to be hard to go to a renewable system. We also can't go on making 100 million barrels per day of oil.
No.
I mean, it's just really hard to do. And that is why I believe there's going to be enormous opportunities to make profits, enormous, exciting, interesting career opportunities. I mean, it's just a great, great sector. And, you know, we're really excited to be part of it.
Fantastic. Well, thanks so much for joining us, Trent.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity and look forward to talking to you again soon.
And thanks to our listeners. If you enjoyed this podcast, please rate us on the app that you listen to and tell someone else about us.
For more ideas and insights,
visit arcenergyinstitute.com.